broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilmsfront, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. The date is Wednesday, the 24th of June, 2020. It is 6:30 p.m. here in Melbourne. We are live on the Wilmsfront YouTube channel. You can interact with the show via the Entropy link that I've put in the live chat, and we are also simulcast on dlive.tv. Now, just starting off, the biggest story in Australia right now is the concern about a second coronavirus wave in Victoria with outbreak hotspots in Melbourne's far north. I'll provide a full rundown of the current state of the outbreak and if we need to worry about further threats from Chairman Dan Andrews about locking us down again following tonight's featured guest. While things do look grim here in Australia, coronavirus-wise, economically and culturally, particularly here in Victoria, spare a thought for the British. Great Britain is in the midst of probably its biggest cultural and identity crisis, a crisis that has been brewing since the collapse of the British Empire following the Second World War. Britain's coronavirus lockdown and the police enforcement was the most draconian in the Western world, which kept native Britons under house arrest, but internationally the borders remained open. But this lockdown was not enforced against Britain's cultural Black Lives Matter protesters, who have also moved on to demanding historical statues being taken down. Nationalists in Britain face their biggest uphill battle to save the nation as they know it, and are up against the entire political, media and global establishment, who are out to demonise and destroy them. So how did Britain arrive in this grim situation? My guest tonight will shed some light upon the current state of British nationalism and if the current neo-Marxist postmodernist trend in the nation can be reversed. Nick Griffin was the face of British nationalism at the turn of the 21st century. He was chairman of the British National Party from 1999 to 2014 and was elected a member of the European Parliament in 2009 for Northwest England, serving until 2014. The British National Party has experienced a decline this past decade. UKIP became the party of choice for many British nationalist voters at local and European elections, but UKIP in 2020 is now also in decline. Nick still contributes to public debate by his Twitter account and Telegram channel, and I'm grateful that he has decided to join us tonight on Wilmsfront. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tim.
I hope you don't mind me mentioning your age, but you're in your 60s now.
You're only just
a veteran of the British nationalist movement, and you joined the movement in your teens when that was the beginning of the mass migration wave to the UK, and when you joined the first nationwide nationalist group, the National Front. So what did you see at the time on the ground in the early 70s, and what inspired you to become involved and dedicate the rest of your life to the cause?
Well, I was brought up in a very political household, very right-wing conservatives. I remember I was only nine at the time, the excitement over the speech made by Enoch Powell, who was the first mainstream figure, in fact, more or less the only mainstream figure, to warn about the impact of mass immigration. And although it was, as he said, only the size of a cloud the size of a man's hand, it was very obvious to people who were political on our wavelength that this was something that would become a very serious problem. But I joined the National Front actually not so much about the immigration issue, that was very important. It was actually over the issue of communism. And in the early to middle 1970s in Britain, there was an assumption by pretty much everyone who was highly political, from the far left of the trade unions right through to the conservative far right, that Britain was heading on the same road as Finland, whereby we were increasingly going to become a Soviet satellite. And the threat of the Red Army crashing through the door with the help of a homegrown fifth column was regarded as a very real serious threat. The Conservative Party seemed content just to, whenever they got into power, to mark time to do nothing to push back against this. So I joined the National Front because they were the people who on the streets were continually attacked physically by the far left, as well as verbally and so on. And when they were attacked, they fought back, which appealed to me.
Yes, you've reminded me that in the early 70s in the UK, well, that was when the trade unions were constantly on strike. There was the three-day working week where you could only get electricity certain days of the week.
Yes, yeah, I did my O-levels when I was 15, 16, literally by candlelight, night after night. It was a very strange time, and although obviously it passed at the time, we all thought, well, this is probably it. It's really serious.
Now, obviously, in the 70s and 80s, there was no internet, let alone social media. Mm. And so political organizations, parties, the way that they got their message out was through letterboxing, distributing literature, and also having to depend on the mainstream media for exposure. And that was around about the time, the 70s and 80s, when the media moguls were being born and owning a lot of the newspapers and other regional outlets. Can you describe activism, nationalist activism in that time?
Yeah, as you say, it's incredibly different to what we've got now, because censorship is pushing us back to the same sort of thing, online censorship. But it's incredibly different to how things were, say, 3 or 4 years ago, before Charlottesville and before the clampdown. Hugely different. The most important weapon for a lad of 15 or 16 and all my mates in the party, of course, were stickers. And we put up thousands of stickers adorning thousands of lampposts, the far left, first the International Socialist, then the Socialist Workers' Party. They also produced stickers, anti-fascist stickers, and we had, anyway, you went regularly. You had a war with activists on the other side that you never saw, taking down each other's stickers and plastering your own on top of them. Then, as you say, there was leaflets, door-to-door paper selling in areas where the local organizer was particularly on the ball and had some real initiative. It was very much trying to get small quantities of the printed word out while the mass media, as you say, already in the hands of the moguls, invariably ignored you and would only ever cover you if it was in a way that could do you damage. That was in the charter of the National Union of Journalists, which was one of the most left-wing of all trade unions. So we really had an uphill battle even to be seen, let alone to be heard.
Now, the National Front, it was both a organization and also a political party. In the 80s, the British National Party, which you led for 15 years, was founded. The original leader of the British National Party was also the original leader of the National Front, John Tyndall, who is now deceased. He was openly white nationalist, and it was easy for the mainstream media in the early days to paint, still to this day, the National Front and the British National Party as a fascist organization. I'll first ask you to comment on who, obviously you worked with John Tyndall for many years, who you thought he was, and those early perceptions and associations of the National Front and the British National Party.
Well, the National Front was formed in 1967-68 by a group of people. Actually, John Tyndall recommended that his followers join it, but he wasn't actually even allowed in to start with. It was founded by a group of men generally who had direct involvement in the Second World War. Its first governing body was absolutely packed with war heroes, several decorated RAF men and so on, A.K. Chesterton, the founder, had fought in the First and the Second World War for Britain, although he'd also been a member of Mosley's British Union Fascists. But Tyndall stayed out because they thought he was too extreme, because John and various of the others who later became key in the National Front had gone through various movements, including the National Socialist Movement in Britain, which you have to say was monumentally stupid. This was a time when any, not even old man, any young to middle-aged man in those very early days was a veteran of the Second World War. And every woman in the street, in a house you knocked on, in London had been bombed in the Second World War. So to hitch your your wagon with a Nazi symbol was really absolutely insane. But having said that, John Tyndall had immense. He was actually a British patriot. He had an argument once with Johnny Jordan, who was the main of the real Nazis. And John said, "Well, if we're going to have a swastika, at least make it a red, white, and blue swastika." Still insane, but you can see he genuinely was a British patriot. There's no doubt about it. And he was also a man, for all his faults, of immense drive and determination and relentless self-discipline. And I don't think there's anyone else I've ever met or almost even heard of who could have effectively found it, because he really did create the NF as it was once he took it over. He could have effectively founded and then built and run two political parties, immense drive. And I would say, although we had clashes later on when, you know, it's two alpha top dogs vying for the top position, it's never going to end particularly well. But I always had a great deal of respect for John Tyndall. His book, The 11th Hour, is still worth reading as a sort of snapshot of how the far right in Britain developed and what its people thought. He's a man, he was in the end hounded to death by the British political establishment, who put him on trial at the same time as me, and he died of a massive heart attack 2 days before one of our court appearances.
You took over as chairman of the BNP in 1999, and is it fair to say you took the party through a professionalising and modernisation phase, and that to a degree was quite successful during the 2000s?
Yes, that started a bit before then. I was working closely with John before, obviously, before he was elected to lead the party. And in, I think, 1997, I wrote an article for the magazine I edited that he owned, Spearhead, entitled No Time for Peter Pan, in which I said that the great stumbling block in a Britain which is now heavily multicultural, where lots of people have got black friends, black family members and so on, is the idea of forced repatriation. And this has, if you're wanting to get anywhere politically, you have to move this to a voluntary basis. Force goes up against so many things and against the British sense of fair play and affection for the underdog, et cetera, et cetera. It simply is not saleable. Might have been when Powell produced it in 1968, but not by nearly the turn of the 2000s. And I argued this. I remember John phoning me up halfway through the article saying, "We can't possibly print this." So I said, "Well, have you read the full article yet?" And he read it and said, "Oh, I see where you're going. And yes, I think we might be able to sell this, but I'm not sure." But we started this, and John actually agreed that, yes, this was going to have to be done if we were going to make electoral headway, which was what the party's aim was. If it had been a movement saying, "We're here to protect the rights of the indigenous Brits, protect our history, etc.," then you either don't need a policy on immigration and repatriation because it doesn't apply, or you can have it as fierce as you like. But when you want to get electoral power, you have to have something which is saleable to the masses. So I started getting my that across in 97. When I was elected in 99, we went full swing into that. And we made a lot of efforts. It took a lot of selling. Some of the hardcore members never liked it, but most got it, especially once we started to have success. So we softened the party's image, professionalised it in every single way possible. And from 2002, we started to win elections. Before that, the British Union of Fascists had won one local council seat in its whole time, despite vast amounts of money poured in by Mosley and Mussolini and huge support. The National Front had never won a single seat. A splinter from it had won two seats. And within a couple of years, we'd won 40, 50, 60, and we're growing from there. So it was a remarkable thing, partly, I think, as a result of the fact that it was the moment at which huge numbers of the British working class in particular started to realise this is getting serious. This isn't just a few places. We've got a serious problem. And whenever we complain about it, the media attack us and smear us and detest us. And at the same time, so that came into combination with the fact that for the first time, there was a party talking about these issues which had made itself seriously electable.
Another obstacle that you and the BNP faced was the fact that there is no free speech in the UK, and during the 90s you were dragged before the courts for an article that you wrote for the Rune under the infamous Public Order Act of the UK, And then there was another legal trial you had to go through with Mark Collette when the BBC's secret agent episode recorded you and Mark at a private event.
Yes, the first one, the Rogan, I was actually the editor, and my local MP complained to the police, and it duly became a court case. And that received very little publicity. It was covered only in the Daily Telegraph and Jewish Chronicle. The Daily Telegraph particularly tickled with the fact that I had a black nationalist there to speak on my side, and I defended myself. We had a great time in Harrow Crown Court in London for 2 weeks. And I was found guilty, but then effectively led off by the judge with a suspended sentence, which was rather unforeseen. And then the second time around was the big one, hugely publicised in Britain, worldwide actually, to a degree. This was two trials in Leeds Crown Court on a total of, it was 16 charges of incitement to racial hatred, either deliberately or sort of accidentally. And as you say, it came about from a secret piece of filming by the BBC. That's not to say that we were in some way caught out. We were speaking at private events, which were still public meetings for anyone who had wanted to come. They weren't advertised as such because the left and the police would have stopped them. But they were open. There was local people there. I said repeatedly, every single word that I said during that speech, or those speeches, it was several of them, I would have said, had I known the BBC were there. Because this was at the time when the grooming scandal by Muslim gangs of thousands upon thousands of young white girls was really starting to brew up. I was warning about this. This was 2004, these speeches that I made. Mark's speeches were mainly about the asylum seeker issue. I was hammering away saying that this grooming issue is a real problem. It's an absolute scandal. And of course, what the BBC showed was the most passionate bits, what I was talking about, this comes from the Quran, and when these people say repeatedly in the Quran that you can take those women which your right hand owns, that's the sword arm, that's the arm that you beat a white lad with a baseball bat with. I was speaking to a working class audience who knew exactly what I was talking about. The BBC showed those bits. They didn't show the parts of the speech when I was saying that the answer to this is not to hate these people or their community, because yes, perhaps their community should speak out, but so should our community leaders. And what have our politicians, our media people, our police chiefs done about it? Absolutely nothing. So the only way to deal with this issue is not to go out attacking Muslims or something like that. It's to get involved in politics and to deal with the people who are really to blame, which is our elite, and then force them to do something. When the juries actually, of course, saw the full speech in context, that's how in the first one we found not guilty on half the charges. Normally the trial would have been dropped at that stage, but the Crown Prosecution Service immediately says, we'll have you back another time. And there we were, dragged through the court yet again. In the end, it blew up in the face of the British political elite. You said that in the 70s and 80s and so on, we didn't have free speech in Britain. It's true to a large degree. This trial in the, well, this was 2006, 2007, by the time it came to court, it actually increased freedom of speech in Britain a great deal. Because after that, people realised that you could say pretty tough stuff about what was going on, and you would be found not guilty. And after that, the Crown Prosecution Service backed off a great deal. They suffered so badly through the publicity and then the disaster of losing that case that we got our freedom of speech back for some years. And it's one of the things, in a way, that UKIP was able to build on. So it was a quite remarkable time, very, very tough for my family. But an immense part of our journey.
I know you and Mark Collette were close in the 2000s. You've fallen out now, but in the early 2000s, Mark Collette was at the centre of another media BNP hit job with the Channel 4 programme Young, Nazi and Proud, where he was secret. Well, he wasn't. He knew sometimes when he was recorded, but then other times didn't know that the camera was on. You vouched for him after that. What did that episode teach you about the, well, you would have been already familiar with the media, how the party was to navigate and try to, I guess, break free of the fascist Nazi stereotype?
It taught me that even the the very brightest, and Mark was and is very bright, even the very brightest, switched on and most cynical youngster simply cannot cope with something like a fly on the wall where someone's following them for weeks on end because their guard slips, they get careless, they get cocky, they want to show off, or whatever it is. Something will go wrong. And whenever you're interviewed, even if it's a straight interview by these people, the only thing they show is your mistake. They don't show the good answers. They show the mistakes. And so they had hundreds of hours of footage of Mark. Some of it, as you say, he knew was being filmed. Some of it was secretly filmed. But he should have known it was secretly filmed. But there again, given his age, I shouldn't have put him there in the first place. So it taught me, as I say, that we never after that did any fly-on-the-wall documentaries. Nobody ever should. With the exception, we did one when I was being followed specifically embarking in the big campaign there in the last main election we were in. And actually, that came out very fair. But I had by that stage an immense amount of experience of handling these people. But generally, without that, nobody should do these interviews. The media are only there to damage us. If you say anything which is good for us, they will not show it. What on earth is the point?
Now, the BNP's rise in the 2000s, it peaked with not just yours, but the BNP won two seats in the European Parliament at the 2009 UK European Parliamentary elections. And that, I remember at the time, the far left in Britain, they really freaked out and they vowed to follow you everywhere that you went to... even though you'd been democratically elected, that your views were not welcome. That was the beginning of their, it's peak now in 2020, their activism of harassment, bullying and threats. And following your election, you appeared on the BBC Question Time program, which is the equivalent of our ABC's Q&A program, and I assume that it's set up the same as our Q&A program, in that the team of producers, they set up all the questioners beforehand with their termed gotcha questions, and you, even though you were just one of many panelists, there was clearly the bullseye on you, and they kept trying to catch you out, saying, "Oh, you have said this in the past, it's on YouTube," and you appeared on the defensive all the time. And a lot of people, and Mark Coletta said this to me in another interview, that a lot of people were disappointed. What was your point of view about how that went down?
Well, I prepared for the Question Time by watching what they'd done when they had, for instance, Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin stroke IRA, on. And they asked him a couple of questions, in effect, have you stopped ordering people to be killed yet? Have you stopped telling people to plant bombs? Then after that, they moved on to discuss, housing crisis and the banking problems and all the rest of it. So I slightly naively thought it would be the same. But I did have discussed this with a number of people beforehand. And I'd done in particular one interview some years before with a fellow called Tim Sebastian on Hard Talk, which ended up just, he was a very aggressive interviewer. It ended up just as a slanging match because I stood toe to toe and went back on them. And it was a terrible piece of television, which we didn't come out all well, nor did he. It was awful. So we decided that I would go on and be defensive, because if I was offensive and aggressive, it would indeed just be a most undignified slanging match. And the idea was that by being defensive, it would activate the underdog, respect for the underdog button that the British public have. And so when people now, especially the left, immediately afterwards, they said, oh, Griffin was so hammered, he's been exposed, now he's going to collapse, now it's going to collapse. It's not true. A year and a half after that, in the general election, the British National Party beat UKIP in the majority of seats where we bid against them. We did better than them. It didn't have a bad effect. So the proof of the pudding is that despite the fact that I was beaten up on television, I was defensive and all the rest of it, in the period before that, the opinion polls had never had the British National Party on more than 6%. In the week after that, that figure went up to 22%. So when people are hostile to me, whether it's from the far left or now people from the far right with an axe to grind, when they're hostile and they say that was a disaster, it wasn't a disaster. It did exactly what it was supposed to do, even though it was painful. And the key thing after that is that that was in 2009. And according to the BBC's rules of how many seats we had and what representation, then I should have been on Question Time exactly the same number of times as Nigel Farage. In fact, I was on that once, which was a public lynching, and he was on 22 times. So what it actually shows, and from that moment, the BBC never put me on anything ever again unless they were forced by the law in an election to do so. So what the BBC actually saw, they put me on and they spent the first half of the programme trying to establish that I was a fascist, which was where I was constantly under attack. In the second half, they let me speak actually quite freely about my views on Islam, my views on the radical promotion of homosexuality, and my views on immigration. And what that was to do was to allow me, in my own words, to establish the fact that I was a racist, a homophobe, an Islamophobe, which of course I duly did. But what horrified them was that when they have no doubt had finished, they thought, well, that's the job done. When they saw the opinion polls afterwards and found that nearly a quarter of the population was saying, yeah, what he said was right, we agree with. That's what after that led to this complete clampdown on the BNP and the BBC's relentless and thoroughly obscene promotion of Nigel Farage. He wasn't just on Question Time. They put him on chat shows, on talk shows, on game shows, on comedy programmes. They put him all over the place because he was the acceptable face of opposition to immigration, because the only immigration he was objecting to was actually white Christian immigration from Eastern Europe. And he wasn't against the immigration that the BBC loved. And he was put on to block the BNP, and that was an extremely successful thing. And that's the key reason the BNP declined and in the end collapsed.
Obviously, the working class voters who voted for the BNP started voting for UKIP and Nigel Farage. And even though they are working class, as you mentioned, Nigel Farage, he only for the past decade focused exiting from the European Union. As you correctly said, he talked a lot about Polish and Romanian immigration to the UK through the Schengen area. I mean, it's fair to say Nigel was an elite. He was a banker, and he ended up leaving UKIP when one of his successors as leader, Jared Batten, hired Tommy Robinson as an informal advisor. So for their BNP's demise, the rise of UKIP, you believe, was a significant factor, but obviously there was a significant amount of infighting. You ended up being expelled. You fell out with Mark Collette. What percentage of that do you think contributed to its demise?
Well, when I was finally expelled from the party, it was already effectively dead. So the demise was down to three things. The factor of UKIP being promoted by the BBC, etc., which we've already covered. Secondly, the equally artificial promotion of Tommy Robinson and English Defence League, which I documented in a document, it's available online, What Lies Behind the EDL. I documented that from material that I found open source on the internet and proved absolutely conclusively in 2012 the extent to which the EDL was literally a Zionist front, funded by neocons from the United States and operated by them. And they had a variety of reasons for doing that, but undoubtedly one of them, again, was to block the BNP. And it blocked us while UKIP was taking away, was damaging the votes. The rise of the EDL took away the main, overwhelmingly working class foot soldiers and potential organisers, the people who would join sort of as populists, the sort of people that the EDL appealed to. And then once they've been in the party a while, came to understand more of genuine nationalist ideology, understand that the problem is much more complex than just Muslim immigration and Islam and so on. And so the rise of the EDL cut us off from that constant source of new recruits. And all political parties, particularly radical ones under pressure, the members tend to have a shelf life. Activists tend to have there's a churn. They're in, they're keen for 2-3 years, then they burn themselves out and drop out. So the EDL cut off that supply. And then the third factor was indeed the infighting. And there was a point at which literally every single meeting, we had 50 or 60 really active branches around the country, plus smaller ones, but 50 or 60 active branches holding a branch meeting every month where they sold the paper, which had just been delivered and so on. They had a guest speaker, things like this. And there was a point at which every single one of these 50 plus meetings, every single month, the left had full reports of who was there and who said what up on their attack websites, even before we got the reports at head office. So there was an immense degree of infiltration. And at a certain point, or at certain points, of course, large numbers of these infiltrators were triggered to take part in or even to inspire and kick off internal divisions. It's one of the things that makes it particularly, I mean, frankly, impossibly hard to build any kind of effective nationalist election organization that you can think could come to power. Because to do that, you have to have some kind of open structure, some kind of democratic structure. And it is so open to infiltration and disruption that it's impossible to keep it going for too long.
It seemed to me that when the English Defence League and Tommy Robinson started to rise in the early 2010s, it seemed that they wanted to close the chapter on the British National Party's history of associations with fascists, skinheads and Nazis, and they focus solely on the Islam issue, and they tried to promote what I called a postmodernist version of British nationalism. They tried to appeal to blacks, Indians, Jews and LGBT people to say that we're the true liberal Democrats of the UK. We're for everybody. But we don't support this ideology and religion, which has this totalitarian tendency, and that had mass appeal, including to me as a young political whippersnapper. But because they were street rallies and there were confrontations, and a lot of them, including, well, Tommy, he is a football fan and had associations with football hooligans, it still resulted in that same thuggish image.
It did, yes. I would say that Tommy, just like Nigel Farage, these people are not nationalists at all. Farage was, as you say, he was a banker, a hyper-capitalist. I sat immediately behind UKIP's MEPs for 5 years and saw how they voted. And given any vote, if there was any kind of clash of interests between the super-rich and ordinary people, the people who voted for them, they always, without fail, took the side of the super-rich. So they weren't nationalists, they were global, they were liberal conservatives. The sort of the Margaret Thatcher types, but even without her social conservatism. Tommy Robinson and co, yeah, they are simply, as you say, liberals, pro-multiculturalism, pro-mass immigration, pro-racial miscegenation, with no policy on anything else at all. They were liberals who hated and feared Islam, generally for the wrong reasons. I mean, I've nearly been in prison twice for criticizing Islam. But I wouldn't criticize Islam, for instance, for generally opposing abortion, for opposing usury, for believing in God and tradition. Absolutely not. Whereas they've opposed Islam, yes, for the right reasons, but also for the wrong reasons, and certainly not for nationalist reasons. But they were very effective at taking our support. It was all quite exciting, the football hooligan stuff and so on. Actually, if you've seen videos of Tommy fighting, he's never been much of a footballer. He couldn't fight his way out of a paper bag, but he's extremely brave, charismatic, and with immense backing of big money. But the real aim of those people, always from the very beginning, was not to save Britain. If you want to save Britain, you have to save the British people who built Britain for a start. So you have to address the question of immigration, miscegenation, culture, and all the rest of it. Their purpose in building that was to wind the white working class up into such a frenzy of hatred against all Muslims that they could persuade Britain to go to war against Iran. That was what the whole thing was about. It was part of a neocon Likud push to get Britain and the United States and other nations as well. It was an Australian Defence League run by exactly the same people. It was part of a push when they'd got a horrible fright in the Iraq War, when they did what they wanted to do, but the middle class basically refused to give their taxes, or started to refuse to give their taxes, and the working class said, you're not having our sons and daughters. So when they wanted a new, unjust, appalling war in the Middle East against Iran, this was part of the operation to set that up, to try to get all of us so fighting mad against Muslims that we'd happily go to war against Iran.
Despite the modern optics of the English Defence League and Tommy Robinson, they still ended up getting demonised by the media and politicians, deplatformed from social media, because obviously the 2010s was the big social media age. Tommy, well, he's still on YouTube, but you can't find his channel, banned from Facebook and Twitter. If you post Tommy Robinson's name on Facebook, you get a community standards strike. And
same with me, incidentally. Same with me.
So it clearly this modernization strategy it didn't lead to political mainstreaming. The demonization tactics by the media were the same, but the only person who face who's survived all of this is Nigel Farage. Brexit has now occurred. They're still there, the 12-month post negotiation, but he's still on all the, well, he has parted ways now with LBC. He's starting to be a bit demonized now, but he has been the most successful, you would say, well, British sovereignty activist in terms of, well, getting Brexit through.
Yeah, absolutely so. And in that, it's one of those very strange quirks of political fate that we in the British National Party set out. We were always against the European Union. I was active as a youngster, and I was just a teenager in the referendum that we had about whether to stay in or leave the common market, which of course was the early incarnation of the European Union. So we were always against it. Nigel Farage was pro the European Union when he was in business as a young banker, until he found out it hurt his business, and then he joined a very early UKIP and took it all from there. But UKIP was always very much a minor party, unknown and completely unsuccessful at all elections other than the European Parliament ones, which uniquely in Britain, or almost uniquely, were based on proportional representation. There was always a big anti-EU bloc, and straight away Nigel was able to get in on that. But they were still very much a minority party and were going nowhere particularly. And I have no doubt that we would have stayed in the European Union, but for this, that, as I've already said, in order to block the BNP, the BBC in particular, but certain other media elements, embarked on the most ridiculous promotion of Nigel Farage as the real but rather slick face of the right and opposed to immigration, but he's cleverer than Griffin and the BNP, blah, blah, blah. And that's what built UKIP into such a force that in the end became, in effect, a kingmaker in electoral terms, and the Tory party didn't dare to go head-to-head with it. They would have lost so many votes. And as a result, Cameron gave the referendum that Farage was demanding, absolutely certain that the result of the referendum would be correct and the British would vote to stay in. But without the BBC effort to stop the British National Party, Farage would never have been in a position to force that referendum. And we wouldn't have got a referendum. We would still be in the European Union. So it's actually a classic example of the law of unintended consequences and what happens if you engage in subverting the democratic process with thoroughly bad aims, as the BBC did. These things blow up in your face. And certainly as a result of that, Farage, he is a very clever politician. He's also an extraordinarily lucky politician. And assuming we do actually finally get out of the European Union and they don't manage to use the COVID nonsense to, in the end, effectively block it, I think we will leave now. I think it's really more or less done and dusted. Farage will go down as probably the most effective politician in the end days of Britain as a nation, because we're going to be a sovereign state thing again. But we are never going to be Great Britain, and we are going to be cease to be British. I'm afraid that is now the way things are going. But for the tail end politician, he is the great survivor and the great success.
Let's talk about the current crisis that Britain finds itself in. You mentioned that in the early 2000s, you were highlighting the prevalence of these grooming gangs. And it's probably the greatest scandal and cover-up in the 21st century in any Western country. So many young girls abused, having their lives ruined. And it was all covered up because of fear of local authorities and police seeming racist. A report has been written about it, but it's currently still suppressed.
Yes, it was. You're absolutely right. I think it probably is the greatest concealed scandal. All the more so that it's actually only one third of the scandal. What's come out and talked about is only one third of the scandal, because 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old girls, normally, yeah, of course they're interested in boys, and normally the boys that they walk around with and run with and form relationships with would be 16, 17, 18-year-old boys of their own group. And the reason that there weren't those 17, 18-year-old boys of their own group hanging around those girls as lads do in normal society is the fact that on the streets of those towns, if young white lads of 15 and 16 and 17 go out, they are intimidated, kicked around, beaten, and occasionally stabbed to death by the same gangs. So for every girl who's been seduced and gang raped, there's a boy who's been intimidated and beaten. Hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of them. And no one's ever talked about that. And the other factor, of course, is that in both the case of demoralizing the young lads weakening the resistance of young girls, it's drugs, hard drugs, pushed by the same gangs. Again, for everyone that's come out who's had her life ruined by particularly brutal rapes and all the rest of it, there's another one who's died of a heroin overdose. And so the whole thing is a scandal of monstrous proportions, and it is effectively a war against a whole generation of our people.
And the UK police, as well as not being timid when it comes to these grooming gangs, they're known worldwide now as the most politically correct police force. They can't crack down on knife crime in London or acid attacks, which are also prevalent in London, but they can knock down your front door if you said some mean words on the internet. And of course, the most most infamous and ridiculous visits from the police if you've misgendered somebody on the internet.
Yes, absolutely so. I guess we're the worst, but I've seen some examples of pretty shocking politically correct policing elsewhere in the world. I think there's perhaps something a bit special. You might have it in the US, in Australia, because of the close cultural links. We had an organisation called Common Purpose, which is a training program, and that's really to understate it. It's a sort of a molding machine for people within public service. It looks liberal. It's actually, I would say, effectively cultural Marxist. And Common Purpose has been for a decade or more heavily funded and heavily involved, providing training for civil servants and especially rising police officers. And they've been molded. In turn, there was a time when most British police officers started as particularly tall, particularly tough, working class lads, probably from a grammar school, but going into the police service at 18 and really finding out actually what it was like on the ground. And as a result, they came out pretty decent men. And once they were in charge of the police force in their area, apart from the occasional bit of corruption and Freemasonry, etc., apart from that, they were pretty good. But in recent years, and really since Tony Blair's time, the 2000s, everybody in the police force, certainly everyone who's risen through the ranks, is university educated. And you don't go to university to join the police force and do an engineering degree, because if you're doing an engineering degree, you're going to become an engineer. So these are all graduates from the classics and so on, from the soft courses, from the journalism courses, from the sociology. In the course of that, they've gone through three years of intensive brainwashing at university, and then that's topped up by the Common Purpose ultra brainwashing for people being fast-tracked to run society. So these are now the people running the police force. It used to be said that you couldn't get on in the police force unless you were white and a Freemason. For years now, we have early retired policemen and even serving police officers who joined very quietly. And full 15 years ago plus, we started to be told it used to be white and Freemasonry was the way forward. Now you will not get past inspector unless you are homosexual or Muslim or Marxist. And that's what we've now got running the show. And on top of that, now virtually all the young cops, there's none who are this old, tough, tall working class. They're all of them graduates from this same school. So the police force has been completely transformed. And there's a degree to which they're cowardice when they won't confront an Islamist mob doing something particularly bad, because they know this could easily result in a £10 million riot on their watch. So they don't want that. So there's a degree of cowardice, but more than that, their brains and their hearts are already hell-bent on surrender to these forces in the first place.
And we've seen the peak of such policing during the UK's national lockdown, which I mentioned that native Brits were under house arrest, but the international borders remained open. In Australia, only Australian citizens and residents are allowed in now, and there's a mandatory 14-day isolation where you're cooped up in a hotel, not allowed to leave. But in the UK, you can arrive in Heathrow, you're just told by the authorities to self-isolate, and you can just ignore them. And the UK had some of the worst snitches, I think, in the Western world. And of course, the police officers harassing people in their front yards or patrolling apartment blocks, basically because it's easy. It's tough to go after gangs or knife crime, something that might cause you or others harm. It's easy to harass native compliant Brits.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the start of this, for the first couple of weeks, I wasn't sure what was going on with this. I thought, well, yeah, perhaps it really is serious. But by the tail end of March, there was enough data in around the world for it to be very clear that COVID was actually, it's wrong to call it a flu because it's more like a cold virus, but it's a cold virus with a casualty rate similar to a fairly nasty flu, and that's it. And it's certainly, and if it affects people worse nowadays, it's because as a society, the Western world in particular, tends to be thoroughly obese, thoroughly unhealthy, and we have large numbers of non-whites in the Northern Hemisphere who are not getting enough vitamin D through their dark skins, who are therefore particularly vulnerable to coronavirus. So serious efforts needed to be made, not to bring it under control, but to protect the people who are vulnerable and to let it rip through society, because the sooner we all had it, the sooner it would go away. That's what needed to be done. And it was also very clear by, say, roughly, I should say, beginning of April, that the elites in this are either so grotesquely incompetent in what they're doing with these lockdowns and all their insane ways of treating it, particularly, for instance, saying to people, stay inside, when vitamin D is one of the best defences against this disease, however healthy or unhealthy you may be. So it became clear that the elites running the whole show are either grotesquely incompetent or were doing this for malicious reasons in order to create a crisis to cover their own financial crisis, which I think is part of it, the inevitable collapse of the post-2008 debt economy of the Western world has been covered up. We're going to get the collapse, but people will blame the coronavirus instead of blaming the banking system and the political and media elites. And of course, there's also the question of the power grab. And even if governments didn't start off thinking this is an opportunity to get extra power and surveillance and so on, now it's rolling. They very obviously see it and have taken it as an opportunity to take power. So when I worked this out the very start of April, I put a challenge out on the internet to all the other nationalist leaders in Britain, and I named specifically Nigel Farage, Tommy Robinson, Mark Collett, Paul Golding, all of them. Obviously Nigel Farage is streets ahead of all of those in terms of recognition and power, But it's relevant for everybody. And I said, this thing is a farce and a danger to our people. You all of you need to come out and do what I'm doing. I'm promoting the hashtag lockdown rebellion and saying to people, simply ignore this. We have to break this or it's going to break us. And still to this day, out of all Britain's voices just about still online, etc., from the whole nationalist scene right the way across its board, from its most liberal through to its most extreme, there's only me and Jada Frenson. We are the only ones who call this for what it is and continue to do so. And although we continue to call for people to ignore this, it's patently obvious that actually the British public are sufficiently cowed or sufficiently fooled that they're not going to react against this. I don't even think they'll react when we get a second wave lockdown. I think this monstrosity is the new normal. And I suspect we'll talk about Black Lives Matter in a bit. But with the Black Lives Matter attack on our heritage, and our right to feel proud of our past and so on, and this, they have literally overturned our world in the last 3 months.
I also, before we get on to Black Lives Matter, I want to talk about what's been called, what's developed during the coronavirus pandemic in the UK, the cult of the NHS, the National Health Service. And there's a lot of now migrant NHS workers, and there was that, I would call it taunting, video by migrant NHS workers saying, "You clap for me now," because their workers in the NHS, their neighbours apparently came out and clapped them, basically taunting, "Oh, you used to discriminate against us, now we take care of you, be grateful and suck it up." And of course the media reports were the hospitals were overwhelmed and nurses were working overtime, but I've lost count of how many of TikTok, that Chinese-owned video app, all those NHS nurses doing all those choreographed TikTok dances, which of course shows that they've got no work because they've sent people getting cancer treatment home, and it was just looked insulting and disgusting.
It certainly was. Now, my wife and other family members are nurses, so I know exactly how nurses have seen this and what they've been through and so on. And yes, again, there was a little bit of concern right at the start, and very early on they were saying there's something wrong here, more and more and more often. And the average British nurse, and the idea that the British Health Service is run by immigrants, it's a nonsense. Our care homes are largely staffed by East Europeans and Filipinos. To a fair degree, that's true. But actually nurses, and there's quite a lot of doctors who are particularly Asians. But in the health service, yes, if you see an immigrant worker, they're almost certainly one of the cleanest. And the health service, the backbone of the health service, is middle-aged nurses, white nurses who've been there for 20, 30 years and coming to the end of their retirement, coming to retirement. They're the real backbone of the health service. Anyway, and they certainly weren't TikToking. Their position right from the start has been, this is all patronising bullshit. And if you want to thank us, then how about a pay rise, which is above inflation? Because for the last 15 years, we've had pay rises below inflation. So for all that the elite claim to value us, they've been cutting our wages for the last 15 years. And that's the reality of it. But as you say, it has been a cult of the NHS. And again, brilliantly, brilliantly put. And you have to say that whatever the motivation for it, the coordinated propaganda campaign that the liberal elite have run over this exceeds in brilliance and power anything that any regime has ever done anywhere in the world. You talk to people, say, in the old Soviet Union, and they all will tell you, yeah, we didn't believe that propaganda once we'd passed our early teenage years. We didn't believe it. We went along with it because it was too dangerous not to. But in this case, one third of the population of Britain, without a shadow of a doubt, and I'm sure it's the same in most other countries, at least one third of the population believe it. Another third think there's enough in it that they've got to accept this. And the other third are so frightened by the power of this thing that they're not prepared to speak about it, let alone oppose it.
You mentioned the hashtag lockdown rebellion. It turned out it was what I termed the lockdown lovies, the far left neo-Marxists. They decided to do the lockdown rebellion, importing the Black Lives Matter movement, or the new extreme version from the United States, triggered by the death of George Floyd, and they rallied in London, not practicing social distancing, and then of course moved on to the statues, and it was. I remember in one of Paul Joseph Watson's videos, the lunacy of a British Black Lives Matter about UK police brutality. There was only one black man who'd been shot dead by police in the UK the past year, and that was the London Bridge terror attacker.
Yes, absolutely so. Absolutely so. I don't really think there's anything I can add to that. You summed it up perfectly. The thing is insane. Even in the United States, if you actually look at the figures, yes, some innocent black people have been killed by the police. So have far more innocent white people, because there's an element to which the American police, the whole American justice system, is part privatized and particularly brutal. And you don't really want to mess with the American police. And given that George Floyd was out of his mind on various different drugs, a very powerful man, and with a very nasty record, it's really not surprising, actually, that the police were fairly frightened of him, and therefore were fairly foolish how they handled him. But you're right that to apply the, or to try to claim that what's gone on in America, even if you took it at face value, has also happened in Britain, it is farcical. So from that, you obviously have to understand that this Black Lives Matter operation in Britain is not some organic thing, grassroots thing, natural thing. It's deliberately stirred up by extremely well-funded forces. And again, coming back to Black Lives Matter, whether in Britain or America, if you can actually do a little bit of research online, you very rapidly come to understand that you're dealing with a multi-million dollar industry, financed not by George Soros, not just by George Soros, who of course is the bête noire of the entire right. Yes, Soros and the Open Society Foundation have funded it, but also the Ford Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation. Big capitalism is there right at the heart of promoting this rebellion and attempted revolution against the society in which, theoretically, big capitalism is a central part.
These statues that I've lost count of how many statues they are demanding be taken down, or they have taken upon themselves to take down. Obviously, I know who Winston Churchill and Cecil Rhodes are, and they were not bad historical men. You know your British history based on the statues that they want to take down. Are there some statues that are up that are of historically bad people? Or what's your... Because it's so hard to actually get a good historical assessment.
Yeah, well, in the case of the slave traders and these sort of 18th century magnates who are dotted around various of our cities, the men who paid to build the town hall or the library or whatever, some of them do deserve to be taken down. Not, I would say, for their role in slavery, but because particularly when they were bought out and they sold, they were reimbursed and compensated for the loss of their slaves, they piled into the latter stages of the enclosure movement, in which they used their power in the House of Commons to literally steal vast tracts of land, the common lands, from the British people. Everyone knows about, especially in Australia, people know about the famine and the clearances of Ireland and about the clearances of Scotland, of the Highlands. But before that, there was also the clearances of Lowland Scotland, and also the theft and clearances of the English peasantry from our lands as well. So many of those men were involved in the largest whole-scale theft there has ever been since the conquest of 1066. And so if British nationalists, especially English nationalists, wanted to take them down, that would be legitimate. But when you've got foreigners, outsiders wanting to take them down as part of a broader campaign to demonize the whole of our history, this is a monstrously dangerous attack, actually, on British identity, on British culture, and on the potential cohesion of the British people. So, for instance, in my nearby hometown of Shrewsbury, there's a statue of Robert Clive, who was Clive of India, who effectively conquered India for the British. And was accused of, or has been accused recently. He was a hero for a century or more. He's now accused of having enriched himself and caused the Bengal famine and such things. So he's now a target. And when there was a far left mob promising to turn up and remove him a couple of weeks ago. I turned up there and there was 50 local chaps, quite a lot of young football fans and so on, and the left took one look at us and disappeared. So, yeah, some of the figures are men from our history who we should absolutely revere, and some of them are people ranging from some of the slave owners and the thieves of our common lands through to Winston Churchill, Bomber Harris. There's an argument that those men were war criminals and mass murderers, so you could have a debate about whether their statues should be there. But you cannot have mobs of any description, let alone foreign mobs, funded by thoroughgoing Marxist subversives. You cannot have them take down your statues, dismantle your culture, without paying a price in due course which goes way beyond the mere loss of a few statues.
The first Islamic terror attack in the UK in the pandemic occurred just a few days ago, the Reading stabbing terror attack, which it was clear earlier on that it was a terror attack, and I was surprised that the UK police, they actually confessed in the end that it was a terror attack. I noticed, I've got Wikipedia out here, they just call it the 2024 Brie Gardens stabbings. They don't call it a terror attack, but this, it's just, it repeats all the time. I talked about the London Bridge attack last year. That was the second one, and nothing happened after the Manchester Arena bombing, where British girls were blown up.
Yeah, there's a number of factors coming into it. The attacker in this one, well, first of all, the question, was it a terror? Why are they saying it's a terror attack? I think that's going to become clear, because he clears to have deliberately targeted a group of homosexuals. So this is homophobia. So therefore they'll admit that that's a terror attack, because very readily, because the victims aren't ordinary white Brits. In the case of the Manchester bombing, they had to admit that was a terror attack, because when you're going into a place with a large bomb, you know, it most definitely is terrorism. The factor, of course, haven't talked about in either of these cases, but particularly the Manchester bombing, was the guilt, and I use the word directly, the guilt of David Cameron, former British Prime Minister, because it was Cameron with Sarkozy and Clinton who destroyed Libya with the bombing in 2011-2012. They destroyed Libya, got Gaddafi, who was a secular dictator, who was running a very effective, decent country with a decent standard of living, and crushing any Islamists who raised their heads. And they replaced him with a howling wilderness of Islamic extremism. They used, in particular from Manchester, and both obviously the Manchester bomber, but also this latest attacker was part of the Libyan community in Manchester for most of his time here. There's 10,000 Libyans in Manchester. And the vast majority of them came to Britain as Islamist political stroke terror refugees in the time of Gaddafi. And when the time came to overthrow Gaddafi, the British government, the secret services and so on, gave those people the green light to travel back to Libya and supported them, and then used the Royal Air Force to bomb Libyan forces fighting them. So they gave those monsters control of Libya. So this is blowback. It's just the same as 9/11 and the Saudis and the Taliban and so on. This is simply blowback. This is our elite seeking to use Islamist extremists as foreign policy weapons in the Middle East, whether it's against Libya or Syria or Iran or whatever, seeking to use them, hoping that they won't get burnt for the blowback. And of course, very frequently, the political elite don't get caught for the blowback, because they're protected by armed guards and all the rest of it, and they live in nice posh places. The people who get caught in the blowback are the ordinary Brits, like the ones in Manchester or in that park in Reading.
Britain's been through all these horrors, not just the terror attacks, but the ones that I mentioned before, the past 10 years under a supposed conservative government. This lockdown, which has discriminated against the native Britons, that's been implemented by a conservative government. Boris Johnson is considered to be the most conservative of the three conservative prime ministers you've had of the past decade, and as the old argument goes, what exactly is he conserving? He may say some politically incorrect stuff from time to time, but he's not really reversing any trends. And the Conservative Party is always going to be one of the two major parties. They have shunned nationalist activists all throughout the years.
Yes, indeed. Remember Boris, yes, he calls himself a Conservative. If you actually look at what he says and what he does, he's overtly and overly proud of the foreign bits of his ancestry. I mean, lots of people have got some foreign ancestry, it's not a problem. But most in the BNP and the NF before us, before that, we used to have people whose grandparents were Poles or Greek or whatever, or something similar. And many of those were the most proudly, firmly, solidly British of anybody. You know, perhaps there's a little bit of a reaction against it. Whereas Johnson has always gone out of his way to express his pride in his Turkish, Muslim and Jewish ancestry, and to say he'll stand up for those things, those values. And the values he stands for and the modern Conservative Party stands for are values which in the 19th century certainly were recognised as the values of the Liberal Party. And nowadays, it's a hybrid between neoconservatism. The right wing of the Tory party is neoconservative, and therefore traitors to Britain on behalf of the United States and Israel. And the left wing of the Conservative Party are neoliberal, and therefore traitors to Britain and the British interests on behalf of global capitalism. So it's a monstrosity. Really, the Conservative Party should be convicted under the Trades Descriptions Act for using that term. But it does it, and it's very effective, and the people remain fooled. And now Johnson's popularity has absolutely tanked in the last 3 months, partly justifiably and partly because the leftist media have been on his back over every single death with coronavirus. And so his popularity has tanked. The Labour Party have got rid of their completely unelectable, not least because the British mass media so hated Jeremy Corbyn. And they've now got a sort of Tony Blair clone. And it's already quite clear the next election will see Britain go back. It's a pendulum, this thing, between conservative, Labour, and a pendulum. Pendulums are used by hypnotists to hypnotise the people watching a pendulum. And that's precisely what the two-party system does. In every single country where we have it, it hypnotises the people. They believe they have a choice, but they believe the choice they and others make matters. And they watch this thing as our civilization goes down the tubes. And the pendulum is now swinging back to the Labour Party, which will make an even bigger hash of it than the Tories will. And then in due course, it'll swing back to the Conservative Party as the old Britain vanishes.
Well, I've appreciated you, Nick, sharing your experience and perspective on Wilms Front tonight. I know that these days you have the role of an elder statesman passing on your advice to the next generation of nationalists, the Generation Z or Zoomers. As they've called, people can still find you on Twitter for now. I noticed you have a blue check mark. How did you get that?
I've had it quite some time, actually. I can't really remember. I had to send them various documents. I think it would have been extremely hard, even for Twitter liberals, to have denied that Nick Griffin was Nick Griffin. I got that. How I've still got it, how I'm still on Twitter, I don't know. So as you mentioned before, please follow me on Telegram. I've just joined Parler as well. Please follow me on there because I am not retired. I spent several years looking at what the hell's going on here. People have said to me, look, Nick, form a new party. We're ready to join you, all the rest of it. And yes, I could form a new party. And I could say, join us, vote for us, give us your money, and we'll sort everything out. That would be a lie. So I haven't been prepared to do it because this situation that Western civilization is in now is past sorting out. Not going to sort out. We are going to go through a collapse. But that does not mean that you have to take a black pill. You may as well take a cyanide pill. It's all over. The thing that's been killing our people is liberalism. And liberalism is not going to survive the partly structural and partly imposed collapse of global debt, capitalist, consumerism, call it what you will. Liberalism won't survive. And those of our people who make the right choices, starting with personal choices to get away from ground zero. If you live near Reading and you go to the park, you must expect to get stabbed. Because Reading is a multicultural hellhole. So if you go to the park in Reading, well, either you don't go, you move away from Reading if you possibly can, and go to a park which is still our people. And I'm sure this is still the same in Sydney, just as it is in Los Angeles and New York. You have to make this choice. You either stay near the area, which is going to be deadly for people like us, or you go away. or if you have no choice but to go to the park, at least take a heavy walking stick. Because if one person had taken a heavy walking stick to that park in Reading, they would knock the knife out of that knifeman's hand, battered into the ground, and that would have been it. They would then probably have been put in prison for racially aggravated assault, etc., for defending our kind, but he wouldn't have stabbed three people to death and stabbed others. So people have to make the first choice is to, if you possibly can, get away from it, and then to have lots of children, because this is a demographic issue. We are not having enough children. But not just have children, because you also have to make sure that children are reared like us. So my key advice to generation to the Zoomers is, yes, get married, have kids, but above all else, homeschool them and turn off the television. People have to start making those choices. And then as this all collapses, when any time all civilizations collapse, every time a civilization collapses, there are survivors. And the people who survive are those who band together, who work together, who become as self-sufficient as they are. So there's many, many things to do to ensure that the core, the kernel of our civilization, our culture and our DNA goes through what is going to be a bottleneck. So there's plenty to be done. Now I've worked this out and so on, and what we can be doing, and the very many positive things, fun things, far easier things than trying to fight elections and losing all the time. It's very painful, banging your head against a brick wall for decades. Now I've worked that out, I'm in the final stages of writing, I hope, a definitive book about where we go from here. So all your listeners, please come follow me on Twitter while I'm still there, Telegram, Parler, and so on. Keep in touch. I'd love to be back with you in due course as well, Tim. In the meantime, thanks for the platform, and best of luck this evening to all in Australia. Keep safe out there.
Yes, we definitely can't have enough words of warning from people such as yourself in Britain, so it's much appreciated.
Thanks a lot.
Cheerio. Take care.
This is Will's Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
All right, that concludes my featured guest segment for tonight. Now, as I promised in the introduction, I'm going to go through, Victoria's coronavirus hotspots. And the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services has released this infographic on their websites, which shows it's broken down by local government areas. That's what LGA stands for, or council areas. And as you can see there, most of regional Victoria, the grey means no coronavirus cases. There's the bright green means that there's a very low amount of cases there. So there's one up there in Swan Hill, one in Campsie, which is near the Alpine, and then one in the Latrobe Valley. I'll just see if I can zoom in here. As you can see in the Melbourne CBD, there is still a few coronavirus free areas in Melbourne. We've actually got to zoom out here. So where I reside in the city of Frankston, there is no coronavirus cases. Also, city of Monash, where a former studio was, there is no coronavirus cases there. And you can see that it's in the northwest where the hotspots are here. Brimbank, takes in the inner northwest around near Melbourne Airport, Deer Park and Sunshine. 20 cases there, that's got the highest. The city of Hume up here, that has got 13 cases. City of Melbourne, obviously that includes hotel quarantine, that has got 19. And then in the inner north here, Whittlesea, Moreland, Darebin in the inner north, and also Moonee Valley is getting bad. Surprisingly, down here, in the south west, city of Wyndham and the city of, it's going all over the place, this Zoom here, this council area here, if it'll bring it up here, no it won't. Maribyrnong, that's only got 4 cases here. The other hotspots that have been reported, Casey and Cardinia and the southeast, they have stabilized as well. So that is the current state of things. If I zoom zoom out here. Of course, this is a government website, so the graphics or the interactive map is not going to be. So 138 active cases in the community, three interstate. So we still don't, it's not an alarming amount. We had 20 new cases today. It's the eighth consecutive day of double digit increases in Victoria. No other state and territory in Victoria is having these significant increases, despite Victoria and Premier Chairman Dictator Dan Andrews imposing the harshest lockdown of any jurisdiction, where you couldn't play golf even. So June 22nd, on Monday, there was going to be a scheduled relaxation of coronavirus restrictions. Cafes and restaurants were going to be able to serve 50 patrons. That has been kept at 20. However, gyms and cinemas are now permitted to reopen, and ski season and camping can still take place. However, outdoor gatherings have now been reduced or limited to 10, and the number of guests you can have in your house is 5, because Dan Andrews blamed large family gatherings for the increase in coronavirus cases. Spoken like a true communist, blaming the family. He didn't mention it at all, the Black Lives Matter rallies, the Extinction Rebellion rallies, and the refugee rallies, the mass gatherings in Melbourne CBDs, where hardly any of the people there were fined. There are at least four cases traced to the Black Lives Matter rally that occurred in early June there, which Dan Andrews, the Police Minister Lisa Neville, and new Victoria Police Commissioner Shane Patton basically shrugged their shoulders and said, "Oh, it's too impossible to police and find people." Now, based on, if you know the demographics of Melbourne, the northwest of Melbourne, it's a heavy migrant and ethnic area. So is city of Casey and Cardinia. And it's basically been conceded now by the Victorian authorities that language barriers have meant that the message about restrictions and coronavirus might not have got to these migrant communities. So they're sending out liaisons. The Chief Health Officer of Victoria, Brett Sutton, he said he'd spoken with leaders of Melbourne's Islamic community to communicate the message there. Dan Andrews hasn't threatened another statewide lockdown. He's threatened further statewide restrictions, but he has indicated a regional approach to managing coronavirus now. So the reason it's broken down by local government areas now is because they will look at, if it continues to get bad in the northwest, locking down those local government areas while relaxing restrictions in local government areas where there is no coronavirus cases, and potentially relaxing restrictions there, so allowing increased capacity there. So if things continue to go well in the city of Frankston, I won't be subjected to a second lockdown, and fingers crossed that restrictions will be relaxed around here as well. Also, another development today is the military has been called into Marriage Hotel quarantine, which had been managed by private security guards who had been getting infected by return travellers. There's been an increase in return travellers, and then those security guards have been going home and infecting their families, which that's a colossal mess up. So New South Wales, the reason why there'd been no breaches in their hotel quarantine is because they had the military called in, so this is a sensible development. I know that it's freaked a lot of people out, the news reports of the military coming into Victoria. Mainstream media is out to scare us again. They're only coming to manage the hotel quarantine, and they'll do a much better job at making sure the virus is contained there than those private security guards. And as a result of the increase in daily cases in Victoria, panic buying has occurred at supermarkets again. The second wipe, it's been called, because people are buying loads and loads of toilet paper again. And you know the old saying, the old saying is, I think it's Einstein, if you do the same thing and expect another result, that's hardly intelligent. And it's clear the supermarkets did not close during the lockdown. And so, and of course, how is buying toilet paper going to help protect you and your family from coronavirus? And I wonder if these are the same panic buyers as last time, because haven't you still got 6 months worth of supplies that you bought during the first wave of panic buying? So Woolworths today announced that they were applying purchase limits again to toilet paper, hand sanitizer, paper towels, flour, rice, long life milk, eggs, pasta. That it was two per customer now, just to tell. Well, they said they were applying a precaution to the current surge, but maintained that they can keep up with demand and make sure that customers can still get what they need. Because you remember during the first wave of panic buying, elderly pensioners and the vulnerable, they missed out on their weekly supplies of toilet paper. It was incredibly distressing during that time. And you'll remember that all the lefties on Twitter were in love with Dan Andrews, claiming that his lockdown had saved the state of Victoria from coronavirus. But it's actually all falling apart for him now. Of course, we all haven't forgotten about last Sunday's 60 Minutes with his former cabinet minister and former Labor colleague Adam Somniak using taxpayer-funded stuff to branch stack. He also lost Dan Andrews' two other ministers. He has to swear in on Monday three new ministers. And we've seen the mobile testing sites. They've had to basically shut down before they've even opened because they've run out of testing kits. And it appears to me that the reason why Dan Andrews just went to such a draconian lockdown in Victoria, because I think he knew that he was underprepared and that his authorities could not hope. And so he just put everyone under house arrest, hoping that that would suppress the virus. But now it's all unraveling now. And of course, the Cedar Meats outbreak, 98 cases have been traced to that outbreak, and that is within the Brimbank Hume council areas, the one that the Andrews government were very secretive about at the beginning. So it's all starting to come undone now, and it turns out Dan Andrews' testing regime was actually behind the eight ball of other states, so it hasn't done such a great job. And it seems that, well, the first lockdown didn't work, so why would a second lockdown work? And of course, now this has national ramifications with the states that have their borders shut: WA, South Australia, Tasmania, Queensland, Northern Territory. Their state leaders are reconsidering whether to open their state borders. South Australia and Queensland, they're looking to basically open their state borders to everyone except Victorians from those outbreak hotspots. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian advised local businesses in tourist hotspots in New South Wales to deny service to Victorians, basically treat Victorians like the plague. And so there's a national pile on at the moment against Victorians because of this new outbreak. And well, as a Victorian myself, I'd basically advise all the other states and territories, open up your borders to each other, but just close up the Victorian borders, build a wall around it, whatever. For me, within the southeast, they're not being as many active cases as there is in the northwest. I reckon build a moat around the Yarra River. Don't let anyone north of the Yarra in the south. So National Cabinet meets on Friday to decide this. All the other remaining Victorian states and territories are all doing extremely well with the numbers. So I'll continue to monitor we get the daily announcement from Dan Andrews and the health officials every morning about the new daily statewide coronavirus cases. So I'll await Dictator Dan's press conference tomorrow morning. See how many new cases there are. There was 20 today. There was 17 yesterday. So we'll see how this goes and whether they can sort out these mobile testing sites. And we'll also monitor the panic buying as well. Jeremy has said maybe I have some water, Bucko. Yeah, I noticed that I was getting dry lips there. That's been fixed up now. Happens when you talk solo for a bit. So we'll see how the situation in Victoria unfolds. The state of emergency in Victoria has been extended until July 19th. So no, I don't think any major decisions will be made on whether to relax or ramp up coronavirus restrictions. But as I said, we'll monitor the daily amount of cases and where they are in Victoria. That brings us to the end of tonight's Wilms Front program. I would just like to announce that for the near future, Wilms Front will be back to twice a week. Mondays at 7 p.m. Those Monday shows will resume starting the following Monday, and Wednesdays will continue to start at 6:30 p.m. Melbourne time. I feel that there is enough demand to sustain two shows a week again, and it also is doable on my part again, because obviously you can understand I've been very busy moving out of our dedicated studio and setting everything up back in the new home studio. Tomorrow night, of course, will be the weekly Uncuckables. That will remain once a week, 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time on a Thursday. I don't think we'll go back to two Uncuckables a week at this stage. Obviously, I co-host that with David Hiscock, editor of the XYZ. I'll ask him all about the XYZ Facebook page being unpublished due to that, in my opinion, poorly labeled satire article about Waleed Ali praising those eight African girls attacking that teenage white girl. The XYZ satire article claimed that Waleed had defended the girls standing up to white privilege, which that actually reminds me. Yesterday, 3AW reported that there was a gang brawl in Sunbury in the city of Hume with 100 youths there. Obviously, they didn't get the memo about outdoor gatherings had been limited to 10. I assume Victoria Police will find those 100 gang members, will ask them to self-isolate and they will participate in a coronavirus test. We shall see about that. And Trad-Tasman Talk, that'll be back Friday, 6 p.m. on the Unshackled YouTube channel. So that's back at its normal time slot. New Zealand, after declaring itself coronavirus free, now has, at my last count, 9 active cases, which have been linked to quarantine breaches. And so, like Victoria. They've also brought in the military to properly manage the hotel quarantine. So we can thank government stuff ups for the recent outbreaks. Not ordinary people, because, well, you hear about Daniel Andrews' nanny state language has returned, talking to us like we're children. No, Dan, it's you that's stuffed up here. So that's it from me tonight. As I said, I'll be back tonight. Tomorrow night's Uncuckables on YouTube and DLive. And as I've previously said, if you want to support the work of The Unshackled and the production of Wilmsfront, as well as sending a super chat, you can become a member of the Unshackled, a financial member at theunshackled.net/membership. Send a direct donation via theunshackled.net/donate. And of course, we have our online store, which is also now selling Stephen Wells' books, Confessions of a Climate Denier and the Great Coronavirus Swindle. They are also available for purchase on the Unshackled store, which we're very excited. We now have books for sale on the Unshackled store. All right, have a good night, everybody. Stay safe, not just from the coronavirus, but government tyranny as well. And I'll see you again tomorrow.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.